Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today we go in-depth with whistleblower Bogdan Jakovic. He joined us in our round-robin conversation about 9/11 over a month ago, and when he told me he's published a book called Fortress of Deceit, I got a copy, I read it, and then I talked with Bogdan again today. He exposed the serious flaws in airline and airport security both before and after 9/11. And for his revelations about 9/11, he was retaliated against and spent more than 10 years in employed exile at the Transportation Security Agency. It's a fascinating story, and what you're going to hear is a blunt, honest guy who takes seriously his oath to defend the Constitution. And he suffered no fools along the way, and suffered in turn the retaliation of powerful superiors. This podcast is made possible by the people who support my work with your subscriptions. Let's name names, shall we? Susan Gavet has just returned. A glitch canceled her subscription. Welcome back, Sue. Also, Terry Paris, Faith Peoples, Jason Spitzer, and Cheryl Fleming are stalwart supporters of this podcast. Why don't you join them? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then it pulls down. You click on Become a Subscriber, and it takes you to the sign-up page. Thanks for listening. And thanks for your support here at peterbcollins.com. Bogdan Jakovic worked for the FAA before he worked for the TSA. He's a whistleblower.
Leaving home out on the road, I've been down before. Riding along on this big old jet plane, I've been thinking about my
Bogdan Jakovic devoted his career trying to keep air travel safe here in the United States. He worked for the Federal Aviation Administration and then after 9/11 joined the Transportation Security Administration when the Department of Homeland Security was created. And before that, he was annoying people in the Coast Guard where he served before he moved over to the FAA. And Bogdan, I've enjoyed talking with you several times. Our last encounter was brief because I was putting together a series of conversations about 9/11. And today we get to talk without any time constraints. I'm glad to have you back.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
Now, first of all, I thumbnailed your career, but you started off in the Coast Guard. You even served on the bay here in San Francisco for a while. And then you joined the Federal Aviation Administration. And as I said, you also later became a part of the newly formed TSA. And the common thread is that you took your job very seriously, and you were willing to confront, often bluntly if not brutally, the errors that you saw being committed on a daily basis, and you appeared to have no compunction about confronting your superiors. So talk a little bit about your attitude, because I think that's central to who you are and to the very interesting book that you've published called Fortress of Deceit.
It's a difficult question, but basically I grew up with the belief that the United States Constitution was the guiding light for how this country should operate. And I studied the Constitution when I was in college, you know, a little bit as an undergraduate. And then three times in my career, I had to take an oath of office to abide by the Constitution, working for the federal government. And the first time was when I was commissioned as an officer in the Coast Guard. And then right after that, I went to graduate school, but then I came back into the federal government as a civilian criminal investigator. And I had to take an oath, the same oath then. And then again, I had to take the oath, and I think it was 1988 when I joined the FAA as a federal air marshal. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I actually took my oath of office very seriously. And when I saw not only waste, fraud, and abuse, but literally corruption, if not, I don't know how you... I mean, it may not be corruption in the criminal sense, but corruption in the sense of an agency that's being paid a lot of money that's not doing its job.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, that was corruption.
Yeah. And let's focus for a minute on that oath, because the President of the United States, the members of Congress take the same oath, and it is to protect and defend the Constitution. And I, like you, value that standard. And I think that our Constitution is the contract that I have with my government, and I take it seriously. But since 9/11 in particular, we find that portions of the Bill of Rights are considered optional, in particular the Fourth Amendment. And Bogdan, yesterday, after we learned of the massive collaboration by Yahoo with the NSA, where every email was scrutinized for some key words, I called for the resignation of the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, the resignation of the head of the NSA, Mike Rogers, and I even went so far as to say that if Obama doesn't fire them, he himself should resign. And my argument is, and I recognize that none of that is going to happen, but we have lost any standards for upholding that oath of office. And I believe that the Constitution has been shredded in parts to accommodate this burgeoning police state.
Yeah, I agree totally. And like you, I believe that a lot of these people should have been fired. And in Obama's case, nobody can fire him. Well, Congress could. They could impeach him and get rid of him that way. But they're not going to do it because they don't abide by the Constitution either, with rare exception.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're kind of in a crisis state now, where many of us cling to the standards that we were taught in school, but we're kind of the idiots here, because we're being encircled and outwitted by people who have really, you know, systematically reduced, if not eliminated, the rights that are enumerated there in the Constitution.
Right. Yeah, I agree totally.
So, Bogdan, as we look at your career, I want to thank you, because working for the government is thankless in general. But you spent a long time after you basically had been demoted to a desk job and taken out of any significant line of duty. And that was payback, because you were honest about the failings of our security system on 9/11. And you offered testimony to the 9/11 Commission. I've read it. It was consigned to a footnote in their best-selling whitewash book. And so that is the reason that we confer the status of whistleblower on you. And this is a question I've asked every whistleblower who I've met from virtually every federal agency. No one really likes that label. Nobody, you know, consciously says, oh, I want to grow up and be a whistleblower. But talk a little bit about the conflict between your sense of the duty you had to uphold the oaths that you took and the obstacles that were constantly placed in your way.
Yeah, I don't like the term whistleblower either, but I'm not sure what a good term would be, other than the fact that I consider myself just doing my job. You know, it wasn't anything extraordinary. In my opinion, you know, at the time. But what happened in my case is, for several years prior to 9/11, myself and some other guys that I was working with, we knew that the terrorist threat was increasing, and we knew we were going to be hit hard. Now, you have to read my book to get more details on that, because I could talk about that all day.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could figure out that we were going to be hit hard, what happened to the billions and billions and billions of dollars we wasted on the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and all the other alphabet organizations that failed to recognize what the threat was? So anyway, that was just one part of it. The other part, I was working at the time for FAA Security, and I was both an air marshal for a while, as well as a team leader in the what they call the Red Team.
And define that. Explain what the Red Team is designed to do.
A Red Team, by definition, is an adversary team, and I believe the term originally came up from the military in the 1960s or 70s when they wanted to train their own troops against Soviet-type military. And you remember the movie Top Gun?
Oh, sure.
And those guys that were going through the training, they basically fought against Soviet-type aircraft and tactics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what a Red Team is in any type of organization. It's an adversary team.
Right.
And it's designed to give the good guys a taste of how the bad guys operate.
It's like at scrimmage. You got the shirts and the no shirts.
Yeah. Essentially, that's it.
Okay.
But it was a very small unit. There were no more than half a dozen people in the unit at any one time. And for a while, there were only two of us running around the world testing security. So in addition to the intelligence, you know, about the terrorist threat, we also recognized, that aviation security was lagged far behind what the threat was. And so we knew that aviation security was not up to the task of preventing the next terrorist attack. And this is several years before 9/11. And so myself and a guy named Steve Elson, who was also a former Red Team member, in fact, he was the executive officer of the Navy SEAL team that was essentially doing Red Team activities for the United States Navy. And so he and I started working together, and we went to we tried working through the bureaucracy of FAA and didn't get anywhere with these people. So we went to the Inspector General's office to try to get them to do something about aviation security. They wouldn't do anything. We went to the General Accounting Office to try to get them to do something, and we gave them tons of documentation. And, in fact, Steve Elson, he doesn't mince any words, and he makes Donald Trump look like Mary Poppins when it comes to critiquing people that aren't doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
But he put together a binder of documents proving FAA's malfeasance. This is before 9/11. And he put in a blue binder, and he called it the Big Blue Book of Death. And it wasn't a joke. You know, it might sound like it, but it wasn't a joke, because this was a document, a handful of documents, roughly around 2 to 2.5 inches thick, of documentation proving FAA's malfeasance. And we gave this to the IG, we gave it to the General Accounting Office, and even the GAO didn't do anything directly. But I was told by the head of the aviation unit with GAO that he was trying to get Congress's attention to do something about the allegations that we brought up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that still wasn't good enough for us, so Steve and I started going directly to individual members of Congress that were on the various committees and subcommittees that oversaw FAA security, and we gave them this binder, and other documentation. And we had meetings, usually it was with their senior staff members, but we did have meetings with some of the congressmen themselves. And this, we started doing this in late 1998,
mm-hmm.
is when we first started working in this capacity. But So anyway, we had a lot of meetings with Congress. Nobody's doing anything.
And Bogdan, straighten me out if I'm wrong here, but my impression of congressional oversight of airline regulation was that senators and members of Congress would lobby for nonstop flights to either Dulles or National from their hometown. And that was really the extent of their interest in regulating the airlines.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of it. And as I mentioned in my book, I think one of the main reasons Congress didn't do anything is because they get a lot of money from the airline industry, as they do with many other industries, you know, through the legalized bribery of lobbying. So even though we confronted them with information about the terrorist threat, we confronted them with irrefutable evidence about how screwed up FAA was, they still didn't do anything, and I'm convinced they didn't do it because they didn't want to upset this money cart that they got, that they had going on with the industry, because they got millions of dollars a year from the industry. And it was... It was about 2 weeks after 9/11 when I had two separate meetings. It was during the same week, two separate meetings on Capitol Hill. One was with the House of Representatives, and the other was on the Senate side. And in both of these meetings, it wasn't with the actual congressman in this case, but it was with their senior staff that we had worked with. And I'm talking like the brains of the organization in Congress. You know, these are like very, very senior staff members. They called Steve Elson in on one of these meetings, and then my lawyer with the Government Accountability Project joined me on another one of these meetings. But anyway, they basically agreed the obvious, or agreed to the obvious, mm-hmm. obvious that what Steve Elson and I had been telling him was true. But where do we go from here? So Steve and I tried to give him some information on how to correct the problem in aviation security. And the one thing we both recommended is that they not establish a super organization like TSA, because there's just going to be a big money siphon, and you're going to have a bunch of senior bureaucrats just fighting against each other trying to get choice government jobs, and that's basically what happened. But that's not the point I was leading up to. Is at the end of both of these meetings, I asked the senior staff members, when is Congress going to initiate an investigation into all the failures leading up to the 9/11 attacks? And both on the House and the Senate side, they said almost the exact same thing, which was our bosses, meaning the congressmen themselves, will do everything they can to make sure there's not an investigation into 9/11 because it's a big can of worms that they don't want to open. And that is the day I decided to become a whistleblower. And so I went through government channels. There's a specific process you go to through the United States Office of Special Counsel, which is supposedly an independent organization in which a federal employee can file a whistleblower case against his respective bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
So a month later, you know, I spent a month putting together paperwork, filling out all the forms, and I did things exactly the way you're required to as a government employee. And I think it was the last week of October of 2001 in which I formally filed a whistleblower case against the Federal Aviation Administration.
Mm-hmm. And Bogdan, I've never actually asked you for your view of what happened on 9/11, who was responsible, and the extent to which we have been fed lies about what happened and who did it. And this is kind of an open-ended question to you, but what is your view of 9/11? Was it an inside job? Was it permitted to happen? Was it Saudis? Was it Israel? Who do you think was actually behind it?
Well, in my opinion, the government knew 9/11 was going to happen. They knew we were going to be hit. They may not have known the scale of it, but they knew something was going to happen. And Congress, who's we all theoretically report to, or that we're supposed to be accountable to in the federal government, they knew this. I mean, not only from Steve and I, but they had their own sources of investigative tools, including the General Accounting Office and another unit called the Surveys and Investigations Unit of the Appropriations Committee for the House of Representatives. And this itself is a very high-level investigative arm of Congress. And I worked directly with two or three of the investigators from this unit, helping them do an investigation into aviation security. This is before 9/11. And they finished their report in early 2001, like January or February, if I remember right. And I asked for a copy of this report, but the senior investigator wouldn't give it to me, explaining that their reports are so highly classified that literally the only people that are allowed to read them are the individual congressmen that ordered the investigation. Even the senior staff members of Congress are not allowed to see these reports. So I know for a fact that Congress knew that we were going to be hit by terrorists, and I knew for a fact that they knew how screwed up aviation security was. They very deliberately did nothing because for two reasons. One, they didn't want to upset the bureaucratic machine that the government theoretically functions on, and it has nothing to do with the Constitution, which is what it's supposed to be, like we first talked about when we started this interview. But they knew exactly what was going to happen. I mean, like I said, they may not have been aware of the scale or which targets were going to be hit by the planes or whatever, but I know for a fact that they knew about this, and they did absolutely nothing. And the other part of it was the bribe money that they received from the airline industry. They didn't want to upset that apple cart. Mm-hmm. So 3,000 American innocent Americans, and there were some other nationalities involved, of course, but 3,000 innocent people were hideously murdered on 9/11, and Congress goes out of its way to make sure that there's not an investigation. And as you mentioned, you know, I did, in fact, testify at the 9/11 Commission, but Congress made sure that before the thing even started, that the 9/11 Commission was going to be a whitewash in certain key areas, and there's not one word in there that I recall that implicates any member of Congress knowing about this stuff and failing to do anything about it.
And Bogdan, I won't go into a lot of detail here, but do you believe that the airliners that hit the World Trade Centers caused those buildings to collapse, including Building 7, which wasn't hit by an airliner?
Now you're going into the territory of stuff that I don't really know about directly.
All right.
My gut feeling is that the main buildings that were hit, the two Twin Towers, I don't think there was any, I mean, it's just my gut feeling, I don't know. But I don't think there was any subterfuge involved in that. The Building 7 thing, I mean, there's some like big open questions on that, you know, which I still leave unopened. But I, for the most part, and in my book, I don't really speculate about that stuff.
Right.
I just focus on what in fact I did know and what I did experience.
And I really couldn't
tell you.
Okay, that's fair. And let me ask you, just do you have any speculation about Flight 93 that I believe was blown up in the air and scattered over the 25-mile range near Shanksville, Pennsylvania? I have a well-placed source who I firmly believe, who told me that he was on the most secure communications channel on 9/11 and heard the shoot-down order issued for Flight 93, and yet we're told that, you know, it was the heroic passengers who confronted the hijackers and then the plane crashed. That's what we're told.
Right. You know, once again, I'm reluctant to give an opinion about stuff that I really don't know, because I haven't heard your source or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. But One thing I do know is you remember TWA-800?
Sure. Over Long Island. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, it was off of Long Island, about 10 miles off the coast.
Yeah.
I was involved in that fiasco also, in the sense that, make a long story short, I looked at the FBI witness statements of people that claimed to have seen something like a missile
right.
Hit the aircraft, and then the aircraft exploded. And what I did, which no one else in the entire, you know, there are hundreds of people engaged in this investigation after the fact, and nobody did this, but I took the witness statements, which the government pretty much ignored because they all conflicted with each other. You know, some people said the missile went from right to left across their field of vision, others from left to right, and, you know, it was a whole mishmash of stuff. So people just figured they saw, they didn't know what they saw, you know, and they just reported stuff. But anyway, the government didn't pay any attention to them. But what I did is I divided Long Island up into three parts, the west, the east, and the middle, and I placed the witnesses on the map based on where they said they were at the time when they saw this.
Right.
And lo and behold, what I discovered was that all the people that were on the eastern side of Long Island that saw this, they saw the missile move from left to right across their field of vision, every single one of them. The people on the western side saw a mirror image. They saw the missile move from right to left across their field of vision.
And let me quote from your book, which comes right next here. As Sherlock Holmes might have said, elementary, my dear Watson. And yet the FBI and all the other federal agencies involved failed to conduct such a simple analysis. And then you wrote up your concerns in a report.
Right. So I submitted my report to my chain of command, sending a copy to the FBI, as well as another guy that helped me out on this project. And I never received any feedback whatsoever from my own organization, which was FAA at the time. And I had really good rapport with the FBI guys that I was working with at the time. And after a few weeks, after they received this letter, even they refused to return my phone calls and didn't respond to any emails. And so there is no doubt in my mind that TWA-800, which was years before 9/11, like 6 years, something like that, there's no doubt in my mind that that was, in fact, brought down by a missile. So, and I think it very well may have been an accident.
Mm-hmm.
But until you get the truth come out, it's another crime that went unprosecuted.
Well, and it also went covered up. This is a central issue, and the pattern there is one that develops over time, where we see these incidents that occur. And for various reasons, they are covered up or downplayed, and a certain narrative emerges. And I've become critical of these narratives, Bogdan, going back to the Kennedy assassination. I covered the FBI's COINTELPRO operation when it was exposed in the early 1970s. And when you see the pattern of abusive behavior under color of authority that is then rewritten for public consumption, and we have a media that is, it occasionally challenges these narratives, but for the most part, it takes them and packages them and, really supports the cover-up artists. And
right.
And this is the part that, you know, I have so much trouble with. I'm not particularly invested in one scenario or another related to 9/11. I just know I've been lied to. And I hate that. And I resent it. And the lies were used to pave the way for the invasion of Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, all of the Middle East activities that are underway today, the domestic surveillance that I referred to earlier in the Yahoo case, and it certainly goes well beyond that. And so that's where I get uppity, is that I really, find it condescending and insulting when we're told to sit down and shut up, here's the official story, you're not allowed to ask any questions.
Right, absolutely. Until we start having a system where people are actually held accountable for their service to this country, in my opinion, it is not service to the country you know, these people are working for whatever private interests they may have. And you remember President Eisenhower when he left office and he gave his great speech about mm-hmm. the military-industrial complex.
Right.
I don't have any evidence for it, but there is no doubt in my mind that 9/11 was allowed to happen because we weren't engaged in any wars with anybody. And war is a very profitable business, you mm-hmm. know, in the world. And, in fact, the United States sells as many weapons on the world market as the rest of the world combined. I mean, there's a lot of money in this.
Yeah.
And until we, you know, actually get a system where people, particularly politicians, start abiding by the Constitution, which severely restricts who we can attack, you know, essentially we're not allowed to attack anybody under the Constitution unless they're a threat to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we destabilize, like you already said, we destabilize the Middle East with our bogus invasions and wars that we started there that had no basis under the Constitution for us to get involved in.
Right.
It is a crime that is going on here, a major one.
So, Bogdan, let's go back a little bit. I'd like to ask you for a comparison of airline security before 9/11 and airline security after 9/11. And you explained how you led the red teams that exposed the vulnerabilities as you worked for the FAA before 9/11. And we've invested billions. We subsidize the airlines now. They used to pay for airport security. The government does it. It's a federal agency, TSA, that goes through the motions of protecting us. And from my point of view, the vulnerabilities that you exposed before 9/11 have shifted in form, but we're really just as vulnerable today at airports and on flights that are underway as we were on or before 9/11. But you're the expert here, so please give us your view.
I mentioned this in my book where I gave FAA's version of security a zero, meaning that we basically had zero security in the pre-9/11 days, or up until 9/11. And the reason for this, we proved in the red team that you could pretty much do anything you wanted to do at an airport and on an airplane anywhere in the world anytime you wanted to. And I worked all over the world. I mean, there are some countries I didn't go to, but for the most part, you know, I did red team work all over the world. And so prior to 9/11, you know, FAA had a system that was zero security. And then in my book, I mentioned that TSA actually has less than zero security. And you might ask, how can you possibly have less than zero security? And I'll tell you, and I go into this in my book in more detail, but I think it was in 2006 when the British government foiled an attack, a terrorist attack against U.S. aviation coming across the Atlantic Ocean to the United States. The terrorists were going to bomb about 20 U.S. aircraft over the Atlantic Ocean, and it would have caused another 3,000 or so casualties. Well, the British actually broke this story in the news, and they're the ones that foiled the effort. And TSA, on that very same day, is when they came out with that three-by-three rule or something about minimizing the amount of liquid and gels that you can bring on an airplane.
Right, right. I think it's 3 ounces, yeah.
Yeah, 3 ounces. And what preceded that is I knew, and you read the details of my book, but I knew for a fact that we were going to be hit in that same fashion. And I even mentioned 20 airplanes that would be hit using liquid-based explosives. And the reason I did that, in addition to just studying terrorism in general and looking at the wave of how things were going, TSA was in the habit, and the only reason I can think they did this was out of political correctness and to make sure nobody took offense, but they were actually in the habit of telling people via their website and in news releases exactly how its security systems work. So I'm looking at what the threat was and what the capabilities of the bad guys were, and TSA was essentially giving a how-to book on how to bomb U.S. aircraft. And I mean this literally. And I go into this a little bit in my book. And I even knew it was going to be a liquid-based explosive because TSA told them. I mean, they didn't actually come out and say that liquid-based explosives will get through the system, but they would make comments about what type of explosives the system is designed to pick. So if you're a half-witted terrorist, you can figure out, this is what the system's designed to detect. Let's find an explosive that it's not designed to detect, and that's exactly what they did.
And today's airport security theater is as leaky as it was before 9/11, because the red team tests show that they're able to smuggle contraband in at a rate of 80% to 95%.
Right. And TSA, when was it? Was it this summer or the previous summer? I forget where. And a TSA employee brought this stuff out in the news that TSA's detection rate isn't any better than the FAA's detection rate of its own red team doing stuff. So nothing's really changed. But I do have to say, the number one deterrent against aviation-related terrorism right now, it isn't anything the government's doing or the industry is doing. It's because passengers and crew members are much more in tune, obviously, of the potential threat and the consequences if they don't do anything. So that is actually the single biggest deterrent now against aviation-related terrorism, and it doesn't take the billions. What is it? TSA has a $7 billion budget every year to do this nonsense? I mean, it is crazy what our government's getting away with.
And Bogdan, are you familiar with the Maginot Line that France constructed after World War I?
Sure.
And how it was easily defeated by the Luftwaffe because the French hadn't planned on an aerial invasion. And I use that as an example for what we've done. We are reactive. We have hardened our airports in a militaristic way in response to the last attacks and last vulnerabilities. But many remain because we don't think proactively or preemptively. And we simply take steps to prevent something from being repeated. So we had one case of the shoe bomber a single time. And we still have rules that require most people to take their shoes off to clear security at the airport. And I just find that silly. And I believe that random inspection of an unknown nature, so that, you know, if I show up and the guy in front of me gets a free pass, but they decide to go through my socks and see what I, you know, hid in my socks, that kind of random inspection, I think, is a much greater deterrent than the way that they're subjecting everybody to the same process, which enables a dark mind to figure out countermeasures.
I don't really see that as a valuable tool. I mean, it's better than doing nothing. But you can, and I want to be careful here about not providing a how-to manual, so to speak, on how to beat the system.
Sure.
But the obvious thing is you can take a look at, just sit around any airport checkpoint and see how they operate, and you can figure out how to get by them. And even if they're doing a random thing, is it like 1 out of 10 people? If it's like 1 out of 5, well, maybe, you know, it might be something to that. But, you know, it's probably 1 out of 100 or, you know, whatever. But you can figure out what the odds are. And if you're suicidal and you know you're getting caught right at the checkpoint, well, then you blow yourself up right there, you know, and you can do almost just as much damage to the industry just by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but like I said, the randomness is a tool, but I don't look at it as that valuable because you can figure out how to beat that.
All right. I take your point.
what I consider to be the most valuable tool to deter aviation-related terrorism, other than the fact that flight crews and passengers are much more aware of the threat, is human profiling. And when I was doing red team work, you know, I'm a white guy. You know, I've got a foreign name, you know, compared to most people, but I'm just, you know, an average white guy. And the only thing that ever had me concerned about getting caught when I was doing red team activities was a well-trained, well-led human being that was actually looking for the terrorist profile. Because everything else, and I literally mean it, everything else, you do a little research on the internet or at the library, do some observation, you can figure out how to beat every single technological system there is. And I don't care what it is. But the only real deterrent is a human being that is actually looking for the terrorist profile.
But
you can't
also
even mention profiling in this politically correct atmosphere.
But also that human being has to have useful intelligence. And
right.
You describe briefings that you received, and you said you would have been better off just to take a nap. So,
right.
You know, we have all this surveillance, all this monitoring. The NSA and the other intelligence agencies are overwhelmed with the amount of data that they've collected, and they often can't find suspects or critical information because they have so many needles in that proverbial haystack. But, you know, as we look at this, it is mostly just a process of trying to instill fear in innocent people,
right.
in hopes that the real suspect will act in a different way, and you might be able to observe it. But
right.
But you know, talk a little bit about the value of intelligence. It sounds like not much of it trickles down to the operational level.
Right. When I was a team leader in the Air Marshal program, this is in the mid to late 80s and early 90s, we would, before we went overseas on an Air Marshal mission, we would receive a 1 or 2 hour briefing, a classified briefing from somebody from intelligence, FAA intelligence unit. And by the time the information was watered down and filtered and made clean so that no agency would get upset with what's actually passed down to us, it was virtually useless. And after my very first trip overseas as an air marshal, I started to just go to open source information, you know, books, magazines, newspapers, radio, TV, you know, whatever. And I would take notes on terrorism. And this started, like I said, back in the late 80s, and I continued doing it up until 9/11. And there was so much information out there on terrorism from purely open sources that by the time of 9/11, I had 500 pages of terrorism information in a database that I was keeping on my computer, all from open sources. And, excuse me, and before, when I was a team leader in the Air Marshal program, after we received our obligatory official briefing on terrorism, I would give briefings on my own research into the parts of the world we were going from. And I remember one time even there was so much information I didn't even want to talk about it, but I printed out sections of my database and just handed it to my team. And it was much better than the information that we received from official channels.
But Bogdan, there's a little more to this. As you describe in the book, you essentially created your own intelligence database because
yes.
You didn't trust what the official spooks were providing you with.
Right, absolutely. And like I said, I had 500 pages of terrorism information, and it was all collated by country, group, modus operandi, individuals, weapons, I mean, the whole gamut. And it was cross-indexed with each other. The same way, you know, Sherlock Holmes is something of a sub-theme in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it or not, I actually modeled my terrorism database on Sherlock Holmes's own type of system that he had when he was fighting crime in London. and it was all cross-indexed with each other and collated, like I said, and it gave a very clear picture of future events, which was, you know, in this case, 9/11, and then the attempted bombing in 2006. And it was much better than anything that the government was coughing up. And part of it is like political correctness, which is a disease in the federal government. And you know, in my opinion, it's a mental aberration, you know, not calling the shots the way they really are, you know, instead of clouding it with whatever political or religious viewpoint you may have.
Mm-hmm.
And so the information that was given to us was virtually useless. And, you know, the intelligence community, on the they do have a legitimate need to safeguard their methods and operations and people and stuff like this. It's a legitimate function. But the end result is any information that's given to the field is virtually useless.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best thing you could do if you're working in this field is study the open source information on terrorism, because you'll be overwhelmed with it, particularly nowadays because there's so much of it going around the world right now.
So, Bogdan, as we get ready to wrap up here, I want to focus on the retaliation that you received for blowing the whistle, the dead-end jobs that you were assigned to try to get you to quit, and your contact with the Office of Special Counsel, which is tasked with protecting whistleblowers. And I know many whistleblowers who believe that the OSC is quite a failure in that assignment. But you write that in the case that I filed against FAA that was transferred to TSA, they had to respond to a letter from the Office of Special Counsel. There are only two things the agency has to respond to. The first is that TSA has to identify how it corrected the problems that you identified in your whistleblower disclosure. And the second is they have to address the issue of your allegations of retaliation for filing the whistleblower case. You write,
right.
Once the OSC receives the response from the agency, they put a nice cover letter over it and forward that to the Office of the President of the United States, and from there it enters a black hole where it's never seen again. In your case, you say, in 2003, the OSC made a public statement corroborating your allegations against FAA, and then the TSA transferred you from your non-job to an operations center located near Dulles Airport. You were assigned to the graveyard shift, and my entire responsibility, you write, was to wait by the phone. When I hear it ring, pick it up, write down a one-sentence narrative documenting a particular type of flight operation, type one sentence into a computer log, and hit the send button. This occurred 4 to 5 times a night. So, and you had to work the graveyard shift to do this do-nothing job. And this was their way of trying to send you a message that your career was over, right?
Right. Absolutely.
And so
even before that,
yeah, go ahead.
Before I got that graveyard shift job, when TSA started taking over security in February of 2002, officially they hadn't taken it over, but we started getting managers from TSA, you know, starting to make their influence on us. But the very first thing they did was take away all my job duties. And I literally had no assigned work to do for an entire year until February of 2003. And then when the OSC came out and corroborated everything that I said, basically, that is when TSA moved me from a non-job, and I was still getting paid. I was getting paid like $100,000 a year at that time, you know, of taxpayers' money, doing absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then TSA that's when they transferred me February of 2003 to this graveyard shift job. And then I stayed there for about a year, and then they moved me to some backwater part of the agency and working in general aviation. It was a field of security that didn't even exist prior to 9/11, but it was just one of the many tentacles of security where TSA kind of overreached itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent this is one of the things that, when I look at it, it's like mind-boggling to me. But in the first half of my career, which was a total of 32 years, I developed the expertise, one of the few people in the country to do so, to recognize what the terrorist threat was and the vulnerabilities in aviation security. I spent the first half of my career developing this expertise. You'd think I would be some use to the taxpayer and to the country after the fact, but I literally, you know, went from a no job whatsoever, still getting paid, to work in the graveyard shift, and then I spent the rest of my career basically stuck in an entry-level staff job.
And Bogdan, this
a little more than inputting information into a computer database.
This has to
and
really
that was it.
This has to really burn when you, who had a lot to offer, were sidelined, and those who really failed us as leaders on 9/11 were allowed to keep their jobs, if not being promoted. And given even greater authority, unlimited budgets, you can shred the Constitution, and so this really is.
You can do anything you damn want in the government, so long as you play the game, and nobody will touch you.
I mean, this is some kind of a bizarre film noir.
Yeah, and in my book, I equate the government part of it to a mafia, and because when there's no accountability, what else is it? It's like people can do literally whatever they want to do. And like you said, quite a few people from FAA security who deliberately failed to live up to the expectations of what their real job was, many of those were promoted. They were allowed to continue their career until retirement. I know one lady, and I mentioned this in the book, who under FAA, her main job was dispensing cell phones and pagers to people. This is like a minimum level job, you know. Under TSA, she was promoted to an assistant division manager, and she's allowed to retire with more benefits from the government, from the taxpayer, than most people earn during the prime of their working lives. I mean, this is absolutely criminal, what our government is doing. Stealing from the taxpayer is like, it's so routine, it's like people just expect it.
Yeah.
But it's a crime, and it's going to continue until, you know, we elect somebody into office that's going to put a stop to this and start abiding by the Constitution.
So as we wrap up here, Bogdan, just recently in the last week or so, the Obama White House announced that the intelligence community is going to start giving out some new awards to whistleblowers. And the terms are that you have to blow the whistle and do so inside the channels. You have to go to the Inspector General, the Office of Special Counsel, maybe the oversight committees in the Senate and the House. And I note in your book that you were nominated back in 2004 as the OSC's Whistleblower of the Year, including a $25,000 cash award. And you didn't win. But I'm just wondering if I could submit your name for a nomination for this new prize. And see if they might have reconsidered.
Yeah, I mean, go for it if you want. I don't think they'll consider it. But no, in my opinion, this is all just bullshit, what they're doing. And President Obama, when he first ran for office, he made a statement that whistleblowers are an important process of keeping the government clean. And under his administration, he has actually prosecuted more government whistleblowers than every other president of the United States combined. You know, the guy, in my opinion, the guy should have been thrown in jail a long time ago, not just for this, but for other misdeeds. But it is a total joke. And I guarantee anybody, you know, like Snowden or, you know, a new Snowden that comes up, if he comes up with really damning information against a critical government agency, you know, I'm not talking like the post office or something like this, but you know, NSA or FBI or something like this, I guarantee they're going to bury him alive somewhere. You know, I have seen no evidence whatsoever that the government is serious about protecting whistleblowers. They have made it such a difficult process to discourage employees because they don't want employees coming out all the time telling them how bad things are in their respective agencies.
And just to put
that's
a button.
Why I wrote the book. It was, you know, basically a desperate attempt to tell whoever's willing to read it of what our government is doing, and it's actually getting worse, particularly under this administration. And, I mean, I don't know.
The book is called Fortress of Deceit, the story of a 9/11 whistleblower, Bogdan J. Zakovic. And I'm going to spell that for you. It's not a simple name, D-Z-A-K-O-V-I-C. I really respect you, Bogdan, and I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Bogdan Zakovic. Your comments and feedback are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.